Verona Springfield will now give her speech on the human mind in the 21st century scenarios and options. Welcome.
Guten Abend. I'm afraid that's the only German that I can speak, so I do apologize for the fact I'm having to speak in Berlin in English. First of all, I'd like to thank Dr. Machschel for that very generous introduction and indeed for the invitation to come here and to be the first speaker in this enormously important and exciting series that concerns anyone who is going to be a citizen of the 21st century. And why I'm delighted to be here is I'd love to share with you an exploration of a very important question, which is, what kind of people are your children and your grandchildren going to be? And my central idea is that now is the time, unlike any other time in human history, the 100,000 years that we have been around, now is a very special time in that the technologies and in the environment that we're creating with both biomedical science and physical sciences is giving us both the opportunity and the threat to have a different type of person. So what we're going to look at is this very interesting concept of the human mind. Is on the top left, is this what it's all about? And I love showing this picture of holding a brain in one hand. Now I imagine that there are some neuroscientists in the audience. In fact, I know there's at least one very distinguished neurology professor, but can I assume that most of you have not dissected a human brain? Okay, I'll make that assumption, yeah? So let me tell you what it's like, yeah? When I was a student at Oxford, you're standing in a very big practical classroom, and you're wearing gloves, because brains are kept in preservative to make them easy to cut. So they bring these buckets, these plastic buckets in, and you're wearing gloves, and you roll up your sleeve, and you put your hand in, and then you hold the brain, rather like that picture on the top left. And the reason I'm telling you this story is from when I was a student and I was holding the brain like this. And I thought, if I wasn't wearing gloves, what would happen if I got a bit of brain tissue under my fingernail? Would that be the bit that somebody loved with? Would it be a memory? Would it be a habit? What would it be? How do you go from this very boring looking stuff, which occupies the same universe as nasal hair, or earwax, or tooth enamel, or saliva, and yet does so much more for you? Why and how can that happen? And what fascinates me is how you go from the top left to the bottom left. This is George Bernard Shaw. I don't know how familiar you are with his writings. He wrote highly original and controversial works, but they were probably just a pale echo of what was going on behind those piercing eyes that you see there. What's going on behind your eyes, whether they are piercing or otherwise? What's going on behind them? We'll never know. And however close you are to someone, however much you love them, however articulate you are, however poetic, you will never, never be able to share firsthand your experience with someone else. No one can experience the world as you do. No one has for 100,000 years, and no one will ever again. You are unique. Even if you are a clone, that is to say an identical twin, you are special. Your brain is special. What is it, therefore, that makes it special? And that's what we're going to look at first. And then we're going to look at, are we going to be like these people on the top right? I love this picture, because I think that's how they think scientists are. You know, most people, they think that scientists are devoid of emotion, that we lack any kind of humanity, and there we are grinning at some kind of, you know, victory of something. And then bottom right, is this another possibility? Just an abolition of our identity altogether? And that's one of the possibilities I'm going to put before you. So these are our various scenarios that we're going to look at as we tackle the human mind in the 21st century. But before we do anything, what we first have to do is to understand a little bit about how the brain works. And I hope you will bear with me, because not many people put their hands up when I said, who's dissected a human brain? So I'm continuing in the assumption that most people here are not brain experts, right? So in which case, we have to answer that first question, why are you so special? Now, the wonderful thing about being born a human being as opposed to, let's say, a goldfish, is that you have a personality. I hope I don't offend any lovers of goldfish here. Does anyone, I don't have people, oh, but let's be brutal. Goldfish don't have great personalities, do they? You don't have one goldfish having a different character from another goldfish. So that if your children had a goldfish and the goldfish died while they were at school, you could go off to the shop and you could buy another goldfish and the child wouldn't know any difference. Now, you couldn't do that with pet cats or dogs, and even if they wanted you to, you certainly couldn't do it with their brothers or sisters. So what is it about our human brains, especially our human brains, that makes us so different from, let's say, that of the goldfish? Well, this is what you look like in the first 2 years of your life, and you can see here the blobby bits are the brain cells, and the stringy bits are the connections between the brain cells. And I hope you can see that here, I'm showing here, I can't really turn around here, but you can see here in the newborn, 3 months, 15 months, and 2 years, the biggest change is not the increase in brain cells, but the growth of the connections between brain cells. So this means that if you are a twin even, genetically identical, the exciting thing is that you're going to have a unique configuration of brain cell connections. Now, this is what we in neuroscience, we call it plasticity. Now, this doesn't mean, of course, that the brain is made of plastic, but more it comes from the Greek to mold, plastikos. And this is a wonderful experiment I'm going to tell you about now that was done in the States that shows just how sensitive your brain is to what you do and to your environment, that helps mold your connections. Now, this was an experiment involving three groups of adult human volunteers, none of whom could play the piano. Now, if you ever get the chance to participate in such an experiment, a word of advice, try and not be in the control group, because the controls just had to stare at a piano for 5 days. Pretty boring. The next group, however, the luckier group, they learnt five-finger piano exercises. And there was a third group, and I'm going to keep them as a surprise for you. And what we're going to look at in a minute are the brain scans from these three groups of adult humans over 5 days to see what happened as at least one group was learning to play the piano. So if you look first at the control group, you can see that over the 5 days, the brain is literally unimpressed. Literally. Nothing's happened. The brain scans look the same. Now look at the center group, those who are physically playing the piano, and of course you can see there is an astonishing change in the brain territory relating to the digits, even over 5 days. Remarkable. But what I suggest to you, more remarkable still, are the third group. And really, we could spend the whole evening, I think, discussing this experiment. Because look at this third group. As you can see, these people just had to imagine they were playing the piano. And can you see how it's pretty much the same as just physically playing the piano? So we can learn a lot from this. The first is that even a thought can change what your brain, your physical qualities in your brain. And the other is that imagining something is seemingly the same as doing it. And in fact, someone called Huna Kowitz, an Austrian who developed the treatment for Parkinson's in the 1960s, he came up with a wonderful quote. He said, "Thinking is movement confined to the brain. Thinking is movement confined to the brain." And you can see here that that is the case. That the only difference between these two groups of people is that one group were thinking about it and then contracting muscle, and the other group were just thinking about it, and the brain scans are very similar. So I hope you can start to see just how special your brain is. I couldn't resist including this rather nice picture of here's some person just thinking, and you can see how big and fit they become just by thinking compared to these deluded fools doing exercise. Yeah. So it's this thinking that in brain terms, that's what's happening to your brain. Now, what's the basis of that? Well, you can see rather interestingly in here, if we turn to rats and we change the environment of the rats from a simple standard lab conditions to a so-called enriched environment. Now, you can see on the left, enriched doesn't mean to say that the rats come to Humboldt University and hear a series of lectures on the brain and on the future. Enrichment for a rat means that they're allowed to explore, there's lots of obstacles, lots of things to play with. And if you look at a single brain cell, to see the effects of this, it's quite striking. So on the left, you have a brain cell from a rat who was in the control condition. And on the right, I hope you can see, there's a very big difference in that the animal in the enriched environment had far more branches. Now, what's happened? Well, we've just seen that the more you exercise your brain, the fitter, if you like, it becomes. The nerve cells become more active, just like your muscle will start to work harder. But what happens with the brain cell when it's working harder? It doesn't get big like a muscle. It grows branches, as you can see here. Now, why is that important? Well, what you need to know is that by growing branches, you are increasing the surface area of the brain cell. So therefore, it can make more connections. So let's trace this through. A stimulating, enriched environment make brain cells work harder. And those brain cells, when they're working harder, will grow branches, which in turn will enable them to make more connections with other brain cells. And let's think about why that's important. Well, you can see here, this is from our own work, where we looked at enriched environments with imaging, and you can see here, rather like with the piano playing, there's a remarkable change. The more branches you have on your neurons, brain cells, the more connections you can make. And what I'd like to suggest to you is this means you have more of a personalized view of the world, more significance, and an ability to understand. Now, let me just explain how I think this works. When you're born, in the words of a great psychologist, into a booming, buzzing confusion. You evaluate the world because you have no choice in terms of raw senses. How sweet, how fast, how cold, how bright. But gradually, these raw sensations will be a visual pattern. There'll be a smell, a texture, a color, a sound. And if all these things keep coming together at the same time, then like with the people playing the piano, you will start to have connections forged in response to this consistent presentation of the vision, the smell, the color, the patterns. And gradually, that will become, for you, not just an abstract mess of abstract sensations. You'll shift from a sensory world to what we call a cognitive world, from the Latin, I think. It will become your mother. And if your mother, as I hope she has done, features again and again and again in your life, then what will happen is more connections will form in this specialized environment for you alone, such that now if you take a group of people like this, these are colleagues of mine from work, and I imagine that they mean nothing to you. They are not significant to you. They are generic middle-aged white men wearing suits and ties. Okay? You could substitute in possibly your own colleagues who will mean a lot to you. You will know their names, their history. You'll know when they were upset. You'll know how long they've been working for. You'll know how clever they are, how kind they are. I would see them as men or women or children or whatever. So gradually, the more you go through your life, the more you are personalizing your brain through these connections. And I'd like to suggest to you that that is what the mind is. Now, if that is the case, if one is personalizing the mind in this way, then what about if those connections don't work or we disable them? We can disable them, as shown here, by taking drugs, or in this case, wine, that will stop the connections working. Or we could put ourselves, again, as here, into an environment that just has strong sensations, a beat of music, say. This has happened since the beginning of time, since human beings have been around, and I find it interesting we use the word a sensational time. No one ever says, tonight, we're going to go and have a cognitive time. I don't think, well, perhaps this is you're having cognitive time now, or other people in the sun having a sensational time, but it's very rare. I don't know in German how you say, but in English you wouldn't get English people going to have cognitive time. You can let yourself go. Isn't that an interesting idea? You can let, I don't know if you have, do you have the same in German, to let yourself go? Yeah? Yeah? Similar phrase, yeah? So you're letting yourself go. Now, you can do that not just by wine, women, and song, or drugs and sex and rock and roll. You might do it with a fast-paced sport where you are putting yourself in an environment where there is a premium on the raw senses. I doubt if these people are worried about their rent or their mortgage or their exams or their future. They're there in the moment because the senses are so strong. Oh, another example, this is from my Australian experience from Queensland. I found this very interesting that people were paying money to be totally out of control. This was a selling, I don't know if this is about Australians, but it's a selling point to be out of control. You want to pay money to not be in control. Or for the more sedate among us, frag and I'll swing. You might be familiar with this. Now, all these culturally very different images have in common this notion of getting rid of your self-consciousness, an apotheosis of the sense of self. You're retreating back to being like the child. In all these scenarios, you are again visiting a booming, buzzing confusion. A raw sensation. You've blown your mind. Blowing the mind, here we are. Now, sadly, there's other ways in which the mind can be disabled that are permanent, and this is what I actually work on, but I'm not going to talk about my work this evening, but I'll just mention how we might view dementia or Alzheimer's disease, where, again, one can think of people becoming like children again. So for someone with Alzheimer's, they no longer have the checks and balances that we normally have when we have those connections. Because when you think about it, when you're born, all these senses come in and they are unconditionally accepted. The Jesuits said, give me a child until he is seven and I will give you the man. But gradually, as connections are formed in the way we've seen, you will judge, you'll evaluate your experiences in terms of previous ones. And as you're having that experience, as you've seen, that will modify the connections. So you go from being a one-way street to a two-way street, to having a dialogue between your brain and the outside world. And this dialogue helps you navigate and understand. You see one thing in terms of other things. And so therefore you're equipped to make sense of the world. If those connections start to be dismantled, as in the case in Alzheimer's, then you can no longer do that. You are disorientated, you're confused, you are like a small child who may well enjoy the sun on their face, but they cannot see one thing in terms of other things, so you can often get frightened. You can get very happy, but you'll be very frightened as well, because you cannot make sense of the world. And you can see that here in terms of these connections. So here we see this rather lovely Swedish lithograph of the ages of man or woman here. And here you can see the embryo of the fetus, the early postnatal and mature brain cell, characterized by, as we've seen, the growth of the branches, so you can make the connections. But if these start to waste away, to atrophy, as with senescence and senility, you can't do that anymore. And I should add that Alzheimer's disease is not a natural consequence of aging. It is a disease of older people, which is why it's on the increase. But it is not inevitable, and that's what we're working on. In the questions, I'm happy to talk about that if you wish. So, here we are. This is downtown Oxford. Here we are, going through our life. And everyone has their own sense of time and space. Each of you in this room now have your own life story. You have your own coordinates of space and time that no one else is sharing. And every moment you are on that journey with your past, your present, your future, that is being reflected in your brain connections and making you different, not just from the person sitting next to you, but from yourself a year ago, a month ago, an hour ago, a minute ago, even a second ago. So I'd like to suggest to you that the biological basis of the mind is the personalization of the brain through unique dynamic configurations of neuronal connections that are driven by your experiences. So if that is the case, are we facing a sunrise or a sunset? Could it be that now we have the most marvelous opportunity to exploit and become different and wonderful individual human beings? Or because of the very vulnerability of our brains, are we facing severe problems with this unprecedented environment? So, for the first time ever, I'd like to suggest to you that given the plasticity of the brain, that there's various scenarios. And I'm going to do two scenarios very quickly, and then the third scenario take more time over, because that is the one that I think is dominating in this century. The first scenario I'd like to call the someone scenario. The someone scenario, I'm sure everyone's familiar with Posh and Beck's here. The someone scenario is where you are a someone. You are different from other people. You stand apart from other people. We accept that in Western society. It seems to be something that's been around for a long time. And it actually was started with this man, Bernays, who was the nephew of Freud, who actually realized when he was confronted with how to sell people things that they didn't need, but they might want, how you might do this. And the reason he's got this lady, we've got this lady here smoking a cigarette, was because he was famous for doing something very interesting. At a time when young women didn't smoke, they wanted to increase the number of people buying cigarettes, and they asked Bernays to come up with an idea to get women to smoke. This was in the 1920s. And he came up with this idea that having a pretty young woman smoking and saying it was the torch of freedom, it would say something about you if you smoked a cigarette. You would look free and you would look liberated. Notice he didn't say you'll enjoy it, you need it, but you will look, people will think about you in a different way. And this set the kernel as a very good example of how much of advertising now has picked up that idea, that we all want to be someone, we want to be individual, we want people to think in a certain way about us because of the very symbols that we are using. So just for fun, and you could do this yourselves, I went onto Google and I put in the slogan, "As individual as you are." Okay, just put that into Google, and this is what comes up. All these objects come up, all these things. So if you want to be an individual, you know what to do now. Go out and buy all this, yeah? And then you'll be an individual, yeah? And then you'll find your neighbor has the same dress or the same toy or the same kitchen, and you enter into a kind of arms race for individuality, yeah? Very worrying. This is summarized in a very good book, I don't know if this is published in German, by Oliver James, where he uses the metaphor of a virus, affluenza, to combat this issue that people are trying to use symbols to say something about themselves, and that is motivating them in the West because they are desperate to be someone. But we know that what happens if you have lots of aspirations and you never achieve what you want, you have clinical depression, which is going to be one of the curses of this century. 1 in 4 people, World Health Organization says, will be suffering from clinical depression. So one could say about the someone scenario, consumerism, that yes, you're an individual, yeah, you're an individual if you like, but you're never fulfilled. So it's not really a very happy situation to look at for the future, I don't think. Another is the opposite, and here we have an example of a mass movement where people seem to have sublimated their individuality, and we'll call that scenario the anyone scenario. Now, what's wrong with these mass ideologies, which are still, of course, worrying us so much in the world today? Well, in the mid-20th century, someone called Maclean came up with the idea that these mass movements were attributed to the wiring of the brain, which he said echoed evolution. And you had the reptilian brain, the mammalian brain, and the near-mammalian brain, as you can see, wrapping around like layers of an onion. And he said the problem was when, for whatever reason, these outer layers were disabled, that what would happen is that the reptilian brain would be unleashed. And this accounted for these crowd-like, seemingly mindless behaviors, these wild passions. Now, I disagree with Maclean. You can see here, the French, in particular, I know, have a law for crimes of passion where you are not accountable for your actions, that you do something out of sheer emotion and the outer layer of your brain can't intervene and therefore perhaps you're not guilty anymore. An interesting idea. But in a crime of passion such as this, you are not aware of the narrative, whereas people subscribing to ideologies, or even, dare I say, football crowds, are aware of the narrative. They're aware of the good is or the bad is. They're aware of a plot. They're aware of a storyline. It's not an unbridled emotion. But quite often the David and Goliath story of the little guy up against the big one, and I'm sure we can all recognize that in the current ideologies that worry us today, of the little guy up against some evil oppressor and winning or being right and getting them. It's a very powerful narrative that's gone on since the days of the Bible. But what it is not an unbridled emotion. So the anyone options, I'd suggest to you, may give people fulfillment, but you are not an individual. You are subsumed under a collective narrative. Now I'd like to spend more time thinking about the one that perhaps concerns us most immediately, which is the nobody scenario. Now, what do I mean by the nobody scenario? Well, what I mean is just this, and I don't know how it is for children in Germany, but I was alarmed to read this in the British papers, that nowadays, between a child's 10th and 11th birthday, they are spending 900 hours in class, just under 1,300 hours with their family, and look at this, just under 2,000 hours in front of a screen. Now, given, as I hope I have, you're persuaded that the human brain is very sensitive to the environment, I put it to you, the environment is changing here very radically. So what does it mean if you put a young brain especially, or any brain, and an environment for a long period of time that is a screen-based environment? Might it change the way they are thinking and feeling? Well, this was first of all suggested, and you can see here in Newsweek, on one hand, they thought that on the left, you can see a child like some kind of dominant cyborg. And on the right, Time magazine, the child is some kind of victim, which is the truth. Let's think about this. People of the screen versus people of the book. And this is an interesting quote by a journalist called Kevin Kelly, which I think has both good and bad to it. He says, screen culture is a world of constant flux, of endless sound bites, of quick cuts and half-baked ideas. It's a flow of gossip tidbits, of news headlines and floating first impressions. Notions don't stand alone, but are massively interlinked to everything else. And truth is not delivered by authors and authorities, but disassembled by the audience. Now, when you think about it, when you read a book, it is linear. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. The author, the authority, takes you by the hand, and you follow that person on a journey. Now, it may not be a journey you like, or you agree with, or you enjoy, but nonetheless, one thing follows from something else. No one reads a novel randomly accessing it, or any book apart from a dictionary or reference book. You go through it as a journey. It's a sequence. However, when you go onto Google, or when you go navigating on the web, there is no clear trajectory. You can go whichever way you like. Now, that's both good and bad, but I think it has a profound effect on how we're thinking. Now, just to show that I'm not a complete middle-aged Luddite, I'd like to promote another book here. This is very good, by Stephen Johnson, Everything Bad is Good for You. And he puts some very powerful arguments forward for screen technologies. The most powerful one is that he says IQ levels are rising in many societies, it's true, and that this may be linked to people rehearsing computer games and screen activities, because the skills are very similar. If you're doing an IQ test, you have to see matching patterns, you have to have a great mental agility, and so it is with IQ tests and the screen. So as we've seen, the human brain rehearses and becomes good at what it's doing, like the piano playing. If you rehearse a certain task using lots of mental agility, you'll then perhaps be better at IQ tests. But he also says, and I think this is very important, we don't see a similar increase in symphony writing or in insights into the economic situation or to history or literature or language. And the reason is it's a very different type of skill. This is process, mental process, as opposed to understanding content. To understand content, you have to see one thing in terms of something else, and that in turn requires a conceptual framework that, in my view, needs someone to help you connect things up. You can't just get it. Other people say multitasking is very good, and that's something wonderful to do now with the screen, and you're better at multitasking. I couldn't resist including this as one of the perils of multitasking. You'll end up with houses like this, possibly. I don't think anyone would yet want to do that, and perhaps parents know the conclusion to this science experiment already, that, as you can see, human subjects showing less listening when they're multitasking. You can see brain scans here of listening alone, seeing alone, and then combining the two, showing that the listening is reduced. Perhaps you know this already from trying to talk to your kids while they're multitasking. Another very worrying issue that we should look for in our society, and again, I'm sure it's the same here in Germany as the UK, is the alarming increase in this drug. You may not recognize the name. You might recognize the name Ritalin. Yes? Oh, I don't know what you're prescribed here for attention deficit disorder. Methylphenidate is a generic name for drugs used to teach ADHD. And you can see here there's an alarming rise. Now, this might be because we have medicalized attention deficit. We are now more sensitive to it. It might be that levels by doctors of prescribing has become more relaxed. They prescribe more easily. Or could it be because screen technologies are mandating a short attention span because they come so thick and fast? So I'd like to suggest to you that screen technologies, we may have a shorter attention span. We are presenting people with strongly sensory images, like this. I don't know how many people here play World of Warcraft, for example. It's a very fast-moving science fiction-type activity. And if you're doing that, if you're working with a screen, then when are you going to get familiar with this idea of metaphor, of seeing one thing in terms of something else? Or ideas of abstract concepts, such as this. If I ask you, what is honour? Say you had to explain honour to a Martian. I wonder what you'd do, because honour is a very complex word, culturally so rich, very hard to just show on a screen. And in fact, when I again went onto Google and I typed in honour, I got this. Here's one. Bear in mind, this is English. It's a royal family. There we are. That's honour. Now, if you showed those images to people, they would have no idea really what honour was. So, therefore, we have to think of ways in which we can separate the literal from the abstract. And as I've said, the process, there's nothing wrong with process, it's a very good thing, from actually understanding something. So here we have someone playing the Angry Nerd video game. You can see he looks pretty involved in what he's doing. And it becomes an issue of process. So here, you're playing a computer game to rescue the princess. But do you really care about this noble Princess Yukihime? Do you care about her? I bet you don't care about her. Not in the same way that you care about the princess in Tolstoy. Yeah, so there's a difference. That the princess is a kind of icon, whereas when you read a book, you care about the... Otherwise, why bother reading it if you don't care what happens to people? You care about the narrative, the storyline that the characters are living out. Now, if you're doing something, therefore, that has no meaning, that you don't care about, but is just the raw sensations, will that affect how you feel? Will you have reduced empathy? And it's a known fact that autistic people, these are people who have a problem identifying with others, that they are very comfortable in another activity on the screen called Second Life, which is an alternative to your first life. You can be Vlad the Dragon Slayer, if you choose, rather than an accountant. You can go and do that for a while. So autistic people are very comfortable in that. And again, one wonders if children are doing this kind of thing rather than talking to each other, whether that will impact on them. As we've seen, you have to rehearse to be good at something, and communication in three dimensions requires a lot of things you don't have in two dimensions. Only 10% of human interaction has words of 10% impact, whereas eye contact and body language are 55%, and you can't have body language on a screen. Similarly, your voice, your tone of voice, and unknown inputs from pheromones, the sneaky chemicals that you subconsciously smell, all this will contribute to the very demanding and skillful experience of interacting with someone, even in a professional environment like that, where even there you have physical contact up to a point. Now imagine if you don't have smell or touch or eye contact, you only have a sort of hearing and vision. Of course you have to raise the game, you have to make it stronger in order to have an impact. You have this kind of thing, and I just wonder if people lived this in real life, if they would feel this pleasure in this. I just got that off the screen, you can get endless images like that. What does it mean, therefore, about your identity? If you are engaged in something that is meaningless, that doesn't have a past or a future, will you have a past or a future? And if you look at blogging here, I just had to tell something my cat did today. 2004, my God, cat pictures. 2005, moving cat pictures. 2007, Twitter, that pinnacle of civilization. My cat just sneezed. Cat sneezed again. Cat hasn't sneezed recently again. Now, I should tell you, and I didn't have time to put this in, but if you have to, what is amazing, I was talking to a journalist about this, and I said, I'm very worried that in the future, young people especially, will sit in front of a screen like this and just say, yuck and wow and yuck and wow. Yeah. Now, what happened was because I speak quickly, I'm trying very hard to speak slowly. I hope I'm doing this. Normally, especially when I get excited, I talk quickly. And she misheard this, and when she transcribed it from the tape, she transcribed it as a single word, yakawow. Instead of yuck and wow. Yeah, it's a yak a wow. So it's YAKAWOW. And then astonishingly, much as it went viral, and within several hours, there were 75,000 hits on Google on yak a wow. Yeah. There's t-shirts. Look it up. You'll see. It's astonishing. Yeah? And there's the first church of Yakawao. It was on Fox News in the States. Yeah? And the reason I'm saying this is not just I'm just so impressed by screen technologies now that they can do this. You know, they can outreach so quickly. But also, I think it did touch a nerve. It has touched a nerve. And look it up, Yakawao, you'll see. And what was particularly funny, I said about Twitter. I said, who cares about now I've put one sock on, now I've put another sock on? And you'll see now on the Yakawao site, it has YouTube showing someone putting both socks on at once in defiance of me, yeah, to show me up. So there we are. So that's a slight story of how this thing can go viral and how interesting and how important it is and how we all care. And I think I'd love to do experiments with these 75,000 people who are all now going around saying Yakawao. And it says, welcome to Yakawao with no consequences. So it could become a global debate in a second life. Okay, now again, you see, identity. How do you feel about yourself if you've become a super cyber person? It's very interesting. Finally, I'd like to talk about recklessness, because you can see there's a whole stream of different possibilities here. Some of them might be good, and I'm not trying to give value judgments. I'm just saying these are things we should think about, and certainly those of you who are parents perhaps would like to consider. Now, recklessness is something that we all certainly care about, because if we're talking about consequences, Obama said that the current financial problems was in part due to greed and recklessness. And therefore, risk-taking is good to a certain extent, in excess it's bad. And as employees or employers, we are all very worried about how people take risks. Not taking risks at all is very damning. No one wants to be completely risk-averse. Taking too many is reckless. So let's think about risk. Now, if you ask a neuroscientist to talk about risk, they will try and think of neurological examples of extreme recklessness. And luckily, or unluckily for the person concerned, we've known that a certain condition, a certain area of the brain, if damaged, leads to extreme recklessness. And I'm talking about this turquoise part of the brain here called the prefrontal cortex. We've known this for a long time, since the 1860s, thanks to an individual called Phineas Gage. Now, he's very famous, and he learnt his place in history because of a terrible accident that he suffered. He was the foreman on a railway gang, and it was his job to push down with a very big rod, explosive, in order for boulders and rocks to be blown out the way so that in the 1860s, a railway track could be laid across the United States. And this accident took place in Vermont. And one day, you can guess what happened, as always happens with explosive, yes, it went off prematurely, and it drove the so-called tamping iron through his prefrontal cortex. I'm about to show you a picture of that, a reconstruction. If you are squeamish, you might like to close your eyes. There we are. So what happened, as you can see, is pretty severe injury, and you might wonder why I'm telling you this story, because clearly the poor man must have died. No, not so. He didn't die. Surely he was so brain damaged he there wasn't any use at all. Not so. He could talk, he could walk, he could see, he could hear, to the extent that he actually went back to work with this hole in his head. But then it was over the few months that they noticed, his colleagues, that, for example, among the constellation of very subtle things that went wrong is he was reckless. He was excessively reckless. And just in case you care what happened to him, because he couldn't get on in with anyone, he was behaving in such a bad way. He was impetuous, he was reckless, impulsive, that he left working on the railway and became a fairground freak. And he earned his money just sitting in a fairground showing off his wound, and earned so much money he became an alcoholic and died of alcohol poisoning. That's Phineas's story. But we learned from that this prefrontal cortex, this interesting part at the front of the brain, seems to have some very subtle part to play in who we are. It's nothing to do with the very simple inputs and outputs. And this is from the physician at the time, Harlow, and I'd like to draw your attention to the fact of what he said here. He said, a child, childish, impatient of restraints, childlike. Can you just bear that word in mind, that this prefrontal cortex, if damaged, leads to childlike attitudes, childlike behaviors? Now, what's very interesting, if you look at the brains of children, the prefrontal cortex doesn't actually develop fully, it's not fully operational, until amazingly late in life, late teens, early 20s. When you think about it, that is quite remarkable. So that reflects evolution, where we know that even chimpanzees have a much smaller prefrontal cortex as part of their brains than we do. Another group with an underactive prefrontal cortex are actually schizophrenic people. Now, schizophrenia, contrary to what people think generally, is not a split personality. A schizophrenic person is indeed much like a child. For example, they can't interpret proverbs. If you say to a schizophrenic person or a child, what does it mean? And we have an English proverb, but perhaps you have a similar one in German. People who live in glass houses mustn't throw stones. You have a similar one? If you ask that to a schizophrenic or a child, they will say, oh, what it means is if your house is glass and someone throws a stone, the house will break. That's what it means. They can't use the metaphor because they're not sufficient in making those connections. Also, schizophrenics, like children, are very easily distracted. They see the world in bright, glowing colours. They, too, have an underactive prefrontal cortex, as shown here. The patients, in these cases, are lying on their back, their noses in the air, and you can see the area shown by the arrow. So, another group of people, now we're coming on to the nub of things, interestingly enough, that have an underactive prefrontal cortex, as well as children, are obese people. And this is a study showing that people who are obese are more reckless in gambling tasks. And we know this is linked to an underactive prefrontal cortex because a similar study, a recent study, has shown that the body mass index, that is, the ratio of how heavy you are relative to your height, a high body mass index means that you are heavy compared to your height, such people have proportionally underactive prefrontal cortex. Now, what could all these things have in common? Eating. Well, everyone who eats knows the consequence of eating, but some people eat nonetheless. They enjoy the taste. Gambling. Everyone who gambles knows the consequence of gambling, but they gamble nonetheless because they like the thrill of the gambling. And in schizophrenia, here you can see in psychiatric terms a deterioration in the condition of the cat, but I think in artistic terms possibly an improvement. Top left is a very cognitive cat, and if you go left to right and then onto the bottom layer, you can see by the time you get to bottom right, the cat is pretty abstract. That is not recognizable as a cat. I defy you to recognize that as a cat. It's become sensational, not cognitive. So what I think might be in common with a child, with gambling, with obesity, and indeed with schizophrenia, is just that, namely, the common factor is the press of the senses, that the senses are trumping, you see where this is going now, the senses are trumping consequences. You are in the here and now rather than looking at a past, a present, and the future. So what could be happening in the brain? Well, let's think about computer games and how that might be similar as well. Think about excitement of arousal, addiction, and reward, all of which people say can happen with young people in front of the screen. These three functions, if you like, have a chemical in common, a chemical system in common, and that is a chemical messenger called dopamine that you may have heard of. Now, I should say that dopamine is not a magic chemical that has locked inside it reward. Rather, it's how it works in the rest of the brain that induces the brain into states that will somehow translate into reward or addiction. Every single drug of addiction has the final common path, independent of the chemical messenger it works on, of increasing dopamine. And dopamine has its roots here in the base of the brain like a fountain. And guess where it projects? Up to the prefrontal cortex, where it dampens it down. So I hope you can start to see a pattern here between certain conditions. I'm going to skip that one because I haven't got my glasses on. I can't read it anyway. And I think we don't need to. So let's think back about our sensational time, letting yourself go. All those things we saw, I'd like to suggest to you that they underlie a certain attitude of mind that could be associated with an underfunctioning prefrontal cortex. We can call it the mindless versus the mindful, if you like. Here we have strong feelings. Here we have thinking dominating, so we can contrast sensory with cognitive. Here we have, I can't read it from here. What was that saying? Oh, the here and now. Yeah. So that's living in the here and now. This is the past, the present, and the future. Here the external environment is driving from one moment to the next your mindset. Here the internal narrative of a sense of identity is dominating. This has no meaning. What you see is what you get. It's literal. A cake is a cake is a cake. Doesn't mean anything. It means it's a cake. Whereas in other parts of your life, as you're encountering things, things have a significance or a specialized meaning to you. This is a reduced sense of self. You've blown your mind, you're out of your mind. Here you have a strong sense of identity. Here, no time or space, you're just in the moment. Here you have specific episodes. This is mainly infants and children with excessive dopamine. These, older children and adults with lesser dopamine. And I'm suggesting that this is prefrontal underactivation for those different reasons, whereas this is the prefrontal cortex working normally. And what I'd suggest to you is, whilst we typically go between these two states in our adult life, we like wine, women, and song. We like drugs and sex and rock and roll. We like skiing and dancing and sex and food. Of course we do. And we pay money to do those things. But what if in the future, because the brain is so sensitive, that we start to get out of balance and the screen technology drives and favors the left-hand side instead? So we are infantilizing the brain, or keeping it more in infantilized state. Thinking about the evolution, as I've said, you can see here the dominance of the humans for the prefrontal cortex. What would we lose if we had underfunctioning prefrontal cortex? Well, as I've said, even chimps don't have our capacity for having this expanded prefrontal cortex. So what do we do that chimps don't do? And there's a wonderful book by someone called Stephen Mithen, an archaeologist, who comes up with the idea, if you think about it, that chimps never use symbols. Even though chimps are dexterous and live in complex social hierarchies, you never see the boss chimp with a symbol of tribal status around its neck, do you? You don't have chimps making themselves necklaces to show they're the boss. Whereas, of course, since Neanderthal times, we've done this. And since Neanderthal times, we've had cave art. And this umbrella, I don't know how significant this is. It's quite interesting how big Burberry is. But this is not just an umbrella. It's a Burberry umbrella, which means it doesn't just say to you it's an umbrella. According to the culture you're in, that particular color and pattern will be significant. Some people hate it. Some people think it's a status. But it will mean something. It will say something about you. It will have a significance above and beyond the fact that functionally the umbrella is going to keep the rain away. So, what are the consequences of this symbolic thinking? Well, words and images can actually stand for you. You can start to use symbols, and it's not until a child is 3 or 4 that they have a sense of themselves. They become self-conscious as opposed to others once they start to use words. Now, this self can be distinguished from you. You can have a status, literally a standing next to other people. And this self can have a past and a present and a future. And this is your life story. Although you're evolving as a person, the way we see our identity is in terms of our unique past and our unique aspirations for the future. In fact, having a life story. And in order to have that, you then have a meaning. You have a meaning to your life because there are consequences that can't be undone. There is significance that can't just be replayed in a computer game. And that gives you a sense, I think, of self-worth. So if we compare the future, I think it's not so much that we're going to be fiendish cyborgs. I think we might, in certain cases, in extreme cases, be veering more towards having people like children reacting in the here and now, rather than having a robust and lengthy internal sense of narrative, in which case the nobody scenario would have no fulfillment and no individuality. The anyone scenario, fulfillment, no individuality. The someone scenario we saw, individuality but no fulfillment. There must be another way. I sound like the British elections at the moment. You may have followed this. Everyone's agonizing about another way, to the current problems we're having. So what's here? What's the fourth option here? Well, I would like to suggest to you it's creativity. By being creative, by putting things together, you are expressing your unique take on the world and in a way that's satisfying for you and ideally useful for society. Let's think about creativity. And I know there's at least one artist here, so I feel slightly embarrassed showing this kind of thing. But this kind of picture is a deconstruction of how we would normally see a person. It's a deconstruction to abstract shapes and colors and form to a certain extent, just as we saw the child starts off. So should it be or could it be that by being like a child, you will be automatically creative? Well, here's a painting by a friend of mine's little girl when she was 4. She was called Phoebe, and she painted this sheep. Now, you have to admit, this is unusual. You don't have sheep with purple heads and magenta bodies. Now, why isn't this sheep not hanging in an art gallery somewhere, I wonder? Because surely, not only has it deconstructed the notion of sheep, but it's brought together something unusual. Why is this sheep not a work of art? It's not creative, whereas this sheep is. Damon Hirst sheep. What's the difference? Apart from they're turning in different directions. My suggestion is that the importance is that both have deconstructed ideas of a sheep, Both have done something unusual to the sheep, but what Hurst has done is he's made you think about other things. You're seeing the world in a new way. It might not be a way you like or you agree with, but you certainly think in a different way to how you did before. And for me, that is the third important step of creativity. It's deconstructing or challenging things like children will do, like drug addicts will do, like schizophrenics will do. It's bringing together new things like children will do, like schizophrenics will do, like addicts will do. But unlike those groups, the crucial step is it must say something that makes you see the world in a new way. And it is the same, incidentally, with science as well. So for the first time in 100,000 years, I think the human mind could be radically changed. But let's be honest, it's not so bad. Sometimes it's good to be a someone. If you're fulfilling yourself, if you've set yourself a goal, you've worked hard and you've achieved it. I remember I took 7 goes to pass my driving test, and when I finally achieved that, I was a terrible driver, I felt very proud of myself. Yeah, and rightly so, I think. Yeah. No, I haven't driven since. But, the nobody scenario, we all like times when we are abandoned, where we are not self-conscious, where we forget about the mortgage and our worries, where we can just appreciate the snow or the sun on our faces and our bodies. We like that. Similarly, the anyone scenario, that's good too sometimes if we're working as a team and we're sublimating our selfish agenda for the good of a collective. That can be good as well. So I think the trick is not so much to offer any one of these scenarios, but as always, it's a question of balance. It's a question of having all those things in part of the portfolio of being human. Sometimes to be anyone, sometimes be someone, sometimes be no one, and sometimes to say, Eureka. And that is the conclusion I reach in this latest book, ID. A shameless plug for it here. If it's not available in Berlin, it is certainly available on Amazon, albeit in English. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.